I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, organ transplants are among the most remarkable achievements in modern medicine, offering a second chance at life to patients facing otherwise fatal illnesses. Each year, thousands of people with end-stage organ failure depend on the availability of donor organs. For many, transplantation is the only treatment that can save their lives. Despite these benefits, the demand for organs far exceeds supply. Thousands die each year waiting for a substitute match. This gap underscores the urgent need for public awareness, donor registration, and trust in the system. But recently, rare but troubling cases have drawn attention to how organs are procured, leading to questions about oversight and ethics. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
TPR tells the stories of our city, our struggles and our triumphs. Leaving a legacy gift to Texas Public Radio helps keep those stories alive. Find out how to create your legacy at tpr.org/legacy.
Texas, live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When you think about it, the organ transplant, taking a heart or kidney, other organ from one person and then surgically giving it to another person and then saving their life, when you think about that, it is just amazing. But it's also tragic because we have this medical technology, we have this knowledge how to do this, but for so many, we don't have enough donor organs. And so every year, it's estimated 6,000 people die because there wasn't an organ available for that individual. And now we have a growing trend of people taking their names off of donor registration lists for organ donations. And because there is this heightened fear of organ donating going wrong after a high-profile case in Kentucky where one man was mistakenly declared dead. And so we're going to talk about these concerns, what's being done to rebuild trust, and how organ donations save lives. We're joined by Dr. David Mulligan. He currently serves as professor of surgery, transplantation, and immunology at the Department of Surgery at Yale School of Medicine. And Dr. David Mulligan, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you so much, David. It's an honor to be here.
Well, this is a kind of a tricky conversation to have because I've seen reporting on this situation, particularly this case in Kentucky, and it's done from a kind of a fear factor sort of angle when the news anchor is telling a story like, this is terrible, this happened to this guy, and it could happen to you, and you know, and you read the comments, and people are freaking out in the comments. And so I wonder, like, how do we tell the story that this happened, and it did happen, it's a factual case, but still do it in a way that is informative and doesn't stoke fear and continues to help people understand how important it is that donor organs are critically important.
Well, David, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this because it is so important that the public understand how organ donation and organ recovery and transplantation works. And in the most basic elements of this process, it's important to know that no transplant team, no organ recovery team ever recovers organs from someone who is still alive. And so even though this case illustrates a group of rare cases where there's been this estimation by a particular hospital somewhere in the country where they did some testing, they felt like based on their testing requirements at that hospital that the patient was brain dead, or they withdrew them from life support with the plan for brain death, and they thought that death had occurred, and it wasn't 100% accurate. And then when there was evidence that there was still life, that that patient did not proceed to organ donation, the whole process was halted. The patient was removed and sent to the post-operative recovery unit, and then whatever process necessary from then on took place for that patient to either recover or the patient then progressed over a longer period of time to a longer term event. So the key here is that despite the drama of feeling like someone was mispronounced dead and that their organs were recovered for transplant, the organs weren't recovered, and that we do everything we can to make sure that for transplantation, no one from transplant teams get involved in any process to remove anyone's organs in the United States until the patients are dead and their life-saving gifts, as you articulated at the beginning of the show, the life saves by over 40,000 transplants in this country each year are preserved, and that we're saving lives, we're trying to save more lives. And the last thing we want to do is to have people believe that their organs can be recovered and from their loved ones who are not dead, who have not passed on to that brain death, and that this is really important for people to understand. The only way somebody can get an organ for transplant is through living donors, where the donor stays alive and they get to have that joy of donating a liver, part of a liver or their kidney, to save another's life while they're still alive, and they can enjoy that miracle of transplantation as we just did earlier this week. As you mentioned, I'm a professor of surgery emeritus at Yale, but I've just moved out to Renown Health Medical Center in Reno, Nevada, where we just started a transplant program here to save the lives of hundreds of people on dialysis and with liver failure who are going to need transplant and have to leave the state in order to get those life-saving transplants. So it's passionate for me to be able to speak on this, and it's so important for the public to understand that we have everyone's best interest in mind. The only reason we do this is to save lives of the patients with organ failure. And we're only doing it with these generous gifts from the donors. And we respect those gifts more than anything. And the last thing any of us would ever want to do is to bring harm to somebody who is not aware of their generous gift, or who has gone on to try to donate their organs, but something hasn't met criteria for them to actually be brain dead. That process is halted, and those patients are returned to whatever the progress of their life is going to be, so that we don't do that harm.
It does seem that from whatever reason, there are actors in our society who benefit from trying to erode away trust in medicine in the United States or around the world. We've seen it with vaccines. We saw it with COVID. All sorts of legitimate, proven science-based treatments are being, they're trying to discredit those using pseudoscience in order to sell some sort of supplement or one thing or another. But it does seem like there some people are trying to magnify the risk of a bad transplantation, people being harvested before their time, but I think we need to counter that by hearing the stories of people whose lives have been saved through organ transplants in America, because of this hysteria that's developing about this really jeopardizes the entire system. I mean, shouldn't people be talking about this is critically important, this saves lives? We want to hear from people who did benefit from an organ transplant. And let me give the phone number in case you're listening. You want to talk about that. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. But, maintaining that trust by showing people that this is critically important, it does save lives.
Absolutely, David. It couldn't be more important. The gift of organ donation and the technology and the advancements we've made in this field to be able to save, 48,000 lives a year. Every year for the past 12 years, we've increased the number of transplants we can perform, both deceased donor and living donor, by using advancements in technology, using advancements in immunosuppression, managing patients for longer periods of time very safely with this wonderful, generous gift of organ donation. It's so critical to help people who have organ failure, whether they're little children who were born with genetic defects, or whether they're adults who acquired diseases, including certain cancers that we can do transplants for and save their lives.
All right, we're going to take a break here. When I come back, I'm going to ask you about what Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is doing on this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies with me on the line is Dr. David Morgan. He was the professor of surgery and transplantation and immunology at the Department of Surgery at Yale School of Medicine. He's here to talk about what's happening with organ transplants in America, and these stories that have popped up in some news outlets about the risk of these transplants happening too soon, that the donor organ, the donor, in one case in Kentucky, he was still alive, but it was confusing, but nothing happened to him, and it was, and so no harm, no foul, I guess. But Dr. Mulligan, you know, what's happening with the Department of Health and Human Services under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? They've announced a major, you know, reform of organ transplants systems following an investigation revealing what they said was a disturbing practices by major organ procurement organizations.
Well, yeah, yes, David, I think this embarks back to a big change as we're trying to improve the organ transplantation system over the past, you know, three decades to make it better, to try to save more lives, make things more efficient, and also more cost effective. So I had the honor of serving as the president for the Organ Procurement Transplant Network back during the pandemic, which was a very trying time, as you can imagine, and many things were happening around the country. But one of the things that was happening was a call to attention that the amount of funding that it was taking to support organ transplantation in the way that we had been doing it with the equipment, the computers, the technology, the staff that we had, definitely needed a lot of help. We had a $6.8 million budget. The National Organ Transplant Act, which had been declared by Congress to oversee this contract of one provider, UNOS at the time, who was the solitary contractor and the only contractor allowed to oversee this contract, not a monopoly, but by federal law. And they oversaw how all the process worked. They looked at the quality of transplant centers. They looked at how the process would, the policies that would be used in order to do this. And they did it all on this mild budget. And we had to make up the rest of the cost through registration fees from patients and transplant centers. And so as the government looked at, well, what do we need to do here? President Trump had increased many things for living donation and had done these emergency acts to try to increase support for living donors, time off of work, benefits for travel and housing, benefits for childcare. But the deceased donor system needed even more support. So they proposed a $38 million upgrade, if you will, to support this. And HRSA, the Department of Health and Human Resources, that is overseen by the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Mr. Kennedy, they had overseen this process and put out bids to try to expand and modernize the system. And in doing that, of course, we could all see a benefit. We needed to keep improving and keep expanding. We could use a lot more income to try to make this better. But many people within the system it turned it into a more of a political agenda, possibly, is the best way to put it. And so it became stories like this started to come out, and they started to look at it as perhaps we need to break up this contract, and instead of having one oversight organization, have multiple oversight organizations entertain bids. And so that's the process that's going on right now. They're trying to look at how we can do the best that we can do to improve organ donation and transplantation. But in that process, much of it is throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because unfortunately, there's a lot of mistrust. There's a lot of individuals involved that haven't really been involved in organ donation and transplantation. And then there's a lot of lack of awareness that the part of the government in healthcare that oversees organ procurement organizations and hospitals, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, is different than HRSA, the Department of Health and Human Resources, that oversees transplant centers, and that the goals to increase donation and increase organs per donor are noble to try to save lives, but they need to be in concert with the high quality and the performance and the safety for patients undergoing transplant surgeries to have good outcomes. And so these two branches, the Department of Health and Human Services, need to really be aligned and united. The policies that have been generated through the OPTN, like this one that you're reading about now called continuous distribution, is kind of the most advanced system, using a lot of MIT engineers who are really looking at how to make the most transparent, patient-centered way for us to try to prioritize which patients need which organs first, and how to utilize them and get those patients those organs as quickly and efficiently as possible when they come available. That system just got halted because of a lot of these political issues that have come up. And it's those types of things that are causing a lot of disruption in the organ transplant world. And some of the things that we're trying to do in order to make it better, and yes, everything can improve, and we're trying to do that, but the process has been improving and has been safe and has been more effective than ever before, more successful than anywhere in the world. And yet, you know, we're trying, instead of trying to work on improvements, there's been a lot of disruption. And as you pointed out, there's a lot of people that are caught in the middle, and now they question, well, what in the world is going on? I'm not comfortable with this. And there's a lot of cloud and mystery and drama, which just isn't true. And there's more misinformation, and it becomes a real paradigm and a problem for all of us.
Let's go to a caller. So we got Lisa on the line. And Lisa, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hey, David. Thank you for taking my call. And hello to the physician visiting with you. I'm a retired nurse, but more importantly, my husband is a practicing transplant surgeon. He's been doing it for 40 years. And as a young physician, he came in at the very beginning when it's considered experimental and you couldn't get insurance coverage. And through the years, we've seen medications improve and the techniques and that kind of thing. And he's built his own practice here in San Antonio with some of the best results in the country. But what I wanted to say is that there are a lot easier ways to make a living than being involved in transplantation. It's very hard work. It's often work in the middle of the night. And the people that do this are really dedicated to their patients. They're dedicated to the science of transplantation. And in terms of what happened in Kentucky, you know, that it's very unfortunate. But what I have seen through the years living with my husband and when I was a nurse is that it's a very complex, lengthy process for a transplant to even occur. There's so many checks and balances and much, much work going on with who is going to receive the organ, who is donating the organ. And, you know, it's been the most highly regulated specialty in medicine since the advent of it. And so I'm just hoping that the public will realize that the people that are doing transplantation, their hearts are in it, and that, you know, transplantation results are getting better, and medications are getting better and techniques are getting better. And I think the big thing is just that people trust that being an organ donor is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I just, in all the years I've seen this happen, I've never heard of anything unethical or anything sketchy. It's just all been people working hard to get the best results. And thanks for listening to me.
Well, thanks for calling in, Lisa. I appreciate it. Well, Dr. Mulligan, I have a quick question. So the patient in Kentucky, this is kind of off track here, but he was in the hospital. They thought he was brain dead because of a drug overdose, but then they wanted to harvest his organs. I mean, are people who die of drug overdoses, are their organs suitable for transplantations?
Sometimes they are, David. Sometimes they are. You know, a lot of people that become organ donors have died in ways that are unexpected, and when they die in a tragic accident, or they've had a stroke or a heart attack, and they haven't been able to be revived quickly enough to save their brain, or a drug overdose where some of these new components that they're mixing in, a lot of the drugs that are getting into our country right now,
yeah,
are causing people to have respiratory arrests. And so when those things happen, you know, we try to make sure that the safety of using organs, you know, anything that happened to that donor that caused them to die, that there's nothing that's going to transmit from the donor to any recipient, because we are aware that we have to be careful. There are infectious diseases and things like that, like hepatitis, like HIV. You know, we have to watch for those, and many drug users have some of those infections, but we also have ways to mitigate those, and we can test them really rapidly. So within about 6 hours, we can tell, you know, if a donor has something that we're worried about that may transmit into a recipient. So you're absolutely right. That's as Lisa just said, and thank you so much, Lisa, for those comments. I think as she pointed out, we spend hours and hours when we get organ offers digging through the patient's charts, learning as much as we can about them, and trying to ascertain whether their gift of life-saving for others is going to be safe, and whether it's appropriate or not to utilize those organs.
So let me recap here. This reform that's being proposed by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you think that there's a possibility that it could be doing more harm than good, and that there is a political motivation behind trying to break up the system that we have now? Can you just explain that to me again really quickly?
Yeah, David, I think there's a lot of there are a lot of things that are going on with the modernization to try to improve our system, and we need those things, and we're all in support of the things that are being constructive and helpful to make the system work better. We need to be more transparent about each of those elements, and some of the things that they're doing, like halting some of the progress that we've made in improving organ allocation and distribution, like this continuous distribution policy that's worked so well for lung transplants, that just got halted immediately, and it needs to continue in other organs as well, because these are the ways that we can make more lives saved and improve things. And for various reasons, it's not clear to our community or to the public what is behind stopping and changing gears and trying to redirect how we do our work and pull the people out that have been embedded into transplantation for their entire careers, and to shift gears and go backwards in our progress to trying to make it safer and better, more transparent and more patient-centric. So it's something that I wish the secretary would listen, get more involved in, learn more about, and help us help him to understand what we've been doing for our passionate careers to save lives.
All right. Well, I want to it does seem kind of like a black box on how do you get on top of the donor list? How do you get a needed organ? It seems people don't understand how that works. And they often want, if there's favoritism involved, especially when you hear about a celebrity who gets a needed liver when they can't.
Absolutely. You know, I've been involved in, when I was training, we did Mickey Mantle's liver
Yep, that's
transplant. And
exactly what I was thinking about.
yeah, so I was definitely involved in that, and it definitely is one of these mysterious things. People make a lot of suppositions, but in fact, that's the whole point of why we're trying to continue to make improvements. And that is that if we look at a system that is very transparent, we try to organize a system that wherever an organ is recovered in that region around the hospital, within various nautical mile distances from that hospital, the transplant centers with the patients on their list, how ill those patients are, and what the opportunities would be to get that organ
Right.
to those patients, and offer those organs to the patients that are most in need, that are closer to the donor,
Yeah.
all
So there is
those
a process. We
factors.
just got to make sure
Yeah,
that it's
there's a
transparent.
process.
So,
And
Doctor, I got to
that's
let you go. We're out of time with you, but Dr. David Mulligan, thank you so much. We're going to continue our conversation on the other side with about organ transplantations. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our conversation about the importance of organ transplants, the importance of being an organ donor. We're joined now in studio by Dr. Joe Nespral. He is with the Texas Organ Sharing Alliance, the CEO of the organization. And also we're joined on the line by Jennifer Milton, a clinical assistant professor and a chief administrative officer at the University Health Transplant Institute at the University of Texas Health San Antonio. And welcome to you both, Joe and Jennifer. It's good to have you.
Thank you.
So,
Thank you.
You know, we keep hearing about how 8 lives can be saved with one donation. How does that break down, Joe?
So the breakdown is actually a normal, healthy organ donor. The 8 organs, you can donate heart, each lung, that's 3, liver, pancreas, and 2 kidneys, and a small bowel.
So there's a lot going on there. And so, Jennifer Milton, how often is that happen? You know, is a person really able to, or do by the time, how do you work that out?
Well, there's certainly a waiting list that commands the use of those organs and every, you know, to exhaust the transplantation of people with viable organs available for transplant. So each one of those organs that Joe enumerated, there are large waiting lists of patients geared up and ready, and in most cases dying at the top of the waiting list, hoping one of those organs becomes available in time.
So a lot of people, I mean, I don't even know if, I mean, I would like to be on organ donors list. I'm not sure if I'm on the organ donor list. How do I make sure that I'm on the organ donor list, Joe?
So there's several ways to make that available, right? So the historical classic way is when you go to get your driver's license or re-up your potentially expired driver's license, you can sign up there. But the majority of the folks are doing it now through the Donate Life Texas registry. And you can do that online as well, or you can call them and they can put you on. And so we have access to that 24/7. And when there is a situation in a hospital and we evaluate a candidate for a potential organ donation, that's one of the first things we do is check the registry to see if that's something that he or she wanted to do.
And Joe, even though I am long in the tooth, as they say, would my organs still be any good to anybody?
Absolutely. I think today, one of the most remarkable things that we've achieved over the years is to continue improving and allocating organs that just a few years ago were not being utilized. And so the data and research shows that these organs, the older organs, can work perfectly well. Obviously, you have to start off with a healthy organ, but it doesn't have to be a perfect organ. And I think where many of the transplant programs now are realizing is that an example would be, would it really be applicable to put a healthy 20-year-old organ into a 70-year-old patient, right? Or is it make more sense to put a 65-year-old organ into that 70-year-old patient? So how can we expand and extend that person's life versus the life years of that organ?
Jennifer Milton, it seems like one of the limiting factors is mistrust in the system. People, they're suspicious. And these days, there's certainly a lot of scarcity of trust in almost every organization. What can be done? What do you think we ought to be doing to try and rebuild that trust?
David, you asked a question of Dr. Mulligan earlier that I was on mute, but I cheered when I heard it. And you challenged him. You asked, how do people like you report on these stories in an informative way that doesn't strike fear? And I wanted to add to a story because I think it answers your question, or add to Dr. Mulligan's answer. I think it answers your question is that, you know, for the stories that generated, you know, what we are here to speak about today, that Kentucky story you referenced and the others that were uncovered in Hearst's investigation, one thing never came out of either the newspaper articles in our interview today or in Secretary Kennedy's HHS release, and that is that every single day, families make agonizing decisions to withdraw life support in light of a futile medical situation. That medical situation could have been caused by a drug overdose where the brain went without oxygen, a closed head injury from car accident or a terrible fall. It could be end-stage cancer that patients are facing. But for whatever reason, the hospital attending the physician has come with the family and trying to use guides like living wills or known wishes of the individual, they make a decision to withdraw that individual from life support in light of the futility. In these cases that were investigated by HRSA and that are really wreaking such havoc with the trust in our system, I don't believe anyone has stood up and asked, what happened at the hospital? What happened with those attending physicians that a case they had deemed futile, the patient was now exhibiting signs of life? I can assure you, and as Dr. Mulligan said, and Joe will stress to you, organ donation programs have no role in determining futility and in declaration of death. Their roles are to monitor and follow and preserve every opportunity when someone has actually fully died and then is subsequently able to donate. So you asked what we could do to be informative, and you asked what thoughts on Secretary Kennedy's actions. And what I tell you is, in Secretary Kennedy's actions for HHS, they oversee two organizations, HRSA and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He should have equally called on Medicare to investigate the hospitals where these occurred. What happened with those attending physicians that they were not noticing and responding and reevaluating? Why weren't those nurses comfortable saying something in their hospital space to say, hey, wait, this guy's now seeming to recover? I just want to stress that there are three stakeholders: the organ donation program, the family, and then the hospital, the donor hospital, and the attendings caring for that individual. So I think in my concerns of how these stories keep getting, this particular story keeps getting sensationalized, we're losing trust. That is that people are afraid to be cared for in a hospital where doctors aren't going to, you know, carry on and make decisions regarding the fertility and support their families' decisions to withdraw support. So I would love to see that covered more, and I'd love to see HHS call on those three hospitals to be held accountable. The government calls for us as hospitals in the country, we must have a policy and procedure in place that defines this. That policy is written by the hospital, not our partners at organ donation programs. And the organ donation programs, like I said, get involved after the declaration of death is when they assume that full care.
Well, Dr. Joe Nespral, how difficult is it to know that someone is dead enough to harvest their organs?
So it's interesting. This period that we're going through now is very disturbing, right? I've been in the field since 1988, and we've always relied on the public's trust. And clearly, we saw that accelerate, that distrust, obviously after COVID. We saw that, in different sectors around the country. But obviously, this has exploded and recently, and this case has really, really, it's really disturbed. This is not just a Texas thing. We're seeing this across the country. In Texas in particular, what's very disturbing is that over the last few months, we're averaging around 2,000 people a month taking themselves off the registry. So think about that. These are folks who went out of the way to make that effort and sign up to be on the registry. They've already made that decision. They've made it easy for their families to understand that this is what they want to do. And because of this incident or a couple incidences, they've chosen to take themselves off. So it's very, very disturbing. And we do, I agree, we have to work on increasing the public's trust. So how do we do that? We have to continue educating the general public. We have to highlight the positivity. As Dr. Mulligan said earlier, 48,000 plus folks got that second chance of life last year. And from the organ donor side, we're continuing to push those boundaries to see how we can maximize every opportunity. What people don't realize is that organ donation is actually a very, very rare event. Approximately only 2% of people who die in a hospital, think about that, who die in a hospital have that opportunity to become an organ donor, only about 2%. So it is a very, very rare event. And so for families to come around and recognize that their loved one can be a hero and save up to eight lives, and we call them heroes because these are gifts that are so important. So it's about ensuring that we have the policies in place. We have we work very closely with our donor hospitals.
Sure, so but how hard is it to know that this person should not have been, eligible to be a donor? They said he was brain dead, but he wasn't.
Well, first,
is that a tough call?
First of all, we have to depend on the hospital, as Jennifer said, to evaluate the patient and do what they need to do.
Is it a gross mistake or an easy mistake?
I'm sorry?
Is it a gross, crazy mistake, or was this like, well, I could see that happening?
So I call this a very rare event, right?
Yeah.
Now, could it happen? It could happen anywhere. And in medicine, many things can happen. In this particular case, there's a difference between a patient being declared brain dead and a patient being pronounced dead after circulatory death. In this case, they were attempting to pronounce the patient under circulatory death. And it's a very, very, as Jennifer said, it's a very complex thing. But we are out of it. The transplant programs are out of it. And it's up to them to do that.
All right, we got to take a break here. Sure. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this one-minute break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're back with our conversation about organ donations here in the United States. A number of people are taking their names off the organ donation list after they're hearing these rare stories that have been magnified in certain media about cases where people weren't actually dead when the organ donation process began. Although they were not harvested, things stopped and they were allowed to go back onto their own journey. But it is causing a crisis of confidence in the system, a system that depends on confidence. And so let me ask Jennifer Milton, who is the clinical assistant professor and the chief administrative officer at the University Health Transplant Institute and the University of Texas Health San Antonio. So there's sometimes I hear stories about organs being wasted or damaged, and people are wondering, how much trust can they put in the system when they don't know if the organs are actually going to get to an individual?
Thanks for that question. I would want to be clear to separate it. It's a completely different part of the process in different organizations, but you're right. Another area in our community that can cause confusion and some mistrust. We all have incredibly all arms of this. UNOS, the OPTN, the organ donation and the transplant centers have a lot of team members that work 24/7 and carefully coordinate the handoff of these precious gifts, these precious organs, to get from a hospital, let's say in rural Kentucky, where a person passed away and donated their organs, transported all the way to San Antonio, where we transplanted someone rather quickly. Those staff members are on call looking for handoffs, where the organ comes out of the operating room, gets to airport, arrives in San Antonio, is handed off, and then traveled to our hospital. There have been anecdotal reports, I'm not disputing that they've occurred, that in the entire modern history of organs flying across the organ across the country, that organs had been flying in cargo, for instance. And when the staff got to the cargo hold to pick up the organs, there was damage to the organ that had been on a conveyor belt. I'm proud to say Congress is now looking at changing that so that organs can fly back up and upstairs and not in cargo, which is a different level of coverage. I don't think I've heard stories where an actual organ was completely lost, but any delay increases the risk of that organ not functioning immediately. So we are trying to track those carefully and have just called for, the nation has just called for suggestions from our community on how to better track this and how to look into this so we can make sure we never lose a single organ. I often tell people, when you see a kidney coming into our transplant center packaged and processed in accordance with those federal standards, you need to understand that a human being has waited 6 years for that kidney sometimes, the average wait time in the U.S. being about 5.5 years. And so when that's a different, also lost organs are damaged in transit, the reality is that is just how organs are allocated now throughout the country, and that requires travel. And so we're getting better at that and better at that and learning how to track it better. Organs not being utilized for transplant is really a decision being made by the transplant centers, who are trying to determine that that organ, you asked Joe earlier about the, could you be an organ donor? And I love to tell the story that last year the United States had the oldest organ donor in the country, Orville, a 98-year-old World War II and Korean War vet. And he donated his liver. It went to a 72-year-old woman. Orville didn't donate his kidneys. And although I don't know all of the extenuating circumstances or details in his case whatsoever, it's not uncommon that a person who is in their 90s, their kidneys aren't viable for transplant. So that decision, which organs would work in a patient who is dying, which organs might work best to transplant one of our recipients, those decisions are made in the wee hours over and over by professionals just like Lisa described to you, who dedicated their careers for 40 years. And sometimes what we know is that particular kidney may not work in our recipients. And we want to give people a transplant that's going to last them as long as possible. So there are organs that are donated in the United States, and they are not ultimately transplanted. And the predominant reason for that is that the transplant professionals did not feel they offered a viable chance at a long-term survival for those recipients.
So Dr. Jonas Rawl, San Antonio's Texas Organ Sharing Alliance, I can just imagine how hard it is for a family. They may have just lost a loved one, maybe in a car accident or something, and they just got the terrible news, they're in the hospital, and then the doctor tells them your loved one didn't make it, and they offer their condolences, and the grieving begins. And then not long after, another hospital administration guy comes over and says, listen, we want to talk to you about organ donations. You know, so many people could benefit from your loved one. Your loved one can continue to live on through others. And then sometimes I hear people don't always react well. I mean, it's tough to have grace in a situation like that when you've gone through such a traumatic, horrible, maybe one of the worst days of your life. How does that, and then people have that story to tell, like they came up to me, they wanted, my friends, my loved ones' organs. How do we process that?
So it's actually the hardest thing we do by far. As you just said earlier, family has just been told by the medical professionals, doctor, and let's just say in an ER setting, that your loved one is not going to survive. And that family may need to be there. If it's a brain dead situation, they may be there praying for 2-3 days while they complete all the neurological evaluations and exams. And ultimately, if the patient progresses to brain death, the patient will be declared dead. I mean, brain death is death. And so so you can imagine, you know, our staff who are highly trained, very passionate about what they do. But it is it's a very difficult situation to walk in not knowing this family, not knowing the circumstances and having to discuss this opportunity. And we talk about it as an opportunity, and timing is essential. As you well know, there is a clock that's ticking that we need to move because ultimately those organs are going to start deteriorating. But you have to be very compassionate. I could tell you that things have changed significantly over the years. I think the registry has significantly helped because if we know going in that this is what their loved one wanted to do and they were already pre-registered, that makes that discussion. Right,
having that person's intentions known.
Correct.
Without ambiguity.
Correct. I think where it becomes very difficult is when it's not known. And we used to see that a long time ago when we did not have, the registry did not exist. And so we had many families that were split. Some of them were in support, some were not. And it just made it that much more difficult. So, you know, moving forward, today it's not as it was in the past because we do have a registry. There's a lot more knowledge. And let's face it, particularly here in Central South Texas, where there's a great need, particularly for renal transplantation, pretty much everyone either knows someone who will need an organ, is currently on the list needing an organ, or has passed waiting for an organ.
Well, they may know somebody, but they may not know that about that person.
Correct.
You know, so, I mean, maybe one way to rebuild trust, and I'd love to hear your take on this, Jennifer, is if we talk about this more openly, if we say, you know, I had an organ transplant, I had this, or my loved one did, and so that we see, you know, the community experience, how much benefit there is from this process in order to counter and weigh against these rare anecdotal stories of things gone wrong. And so, real quickly, you know, Joe, if you could tell me your reaction to that observation, and I'll get one from Jennifer.
Yeah, you know, again, it's once it, you know, having prior knowledge, and part of our education to the general public is, you know, have that discussion with your family, right? Let them know. God forbid, we don't want anybody to go through this mm-hmm. tragedy, right? But if it does happen, it's only fair that your family is not put in a difficult situation to have to make that decision. So, you know, let it be known that this is what you want to do. If you really want to go to the next level, you know, put yourself on the registry, and it'll make the process that much more easier. But I think I'd like to say that I really appreciate this time talking about the positive side of donation and transplantation, because recently, as you well know, it's all been negative and it's been affecting the public's trust. So anything that we could do to have these stories, and Jennifer can highlight because she deals with the recipients on the benefit.
Yeah, so Jennifer, give us the positive side.
Give you the positive side? I'll give you the positive side. 62% of Americans with a driver's license in the U.S. have declared that they want to be organ donors. As Joe said, that was limited previously largely to transactions at the Department of Motor Vehicle. And in the nation, MyChart, an Epic entity, just partnered with Donate Life America to bring the opportunity to register your wishes to donate every time you access your own healthcare portal. So I believe, although I absolutely want accurate factual information out there, which I am thankful for you willing to bring out today in your radio show, what I will say is I think Americans need better opportunities to register their wishes. And I think in your own health share and your own MyChart portal is a great place to do that. But I do think that's good news. I think that's good news. And that any opportunity we have to accurately desensationalize these stories and say the OPOs weren't overly aggressive in this situation. People make the decision to withdraw their loved ones from life support every day in anguish. And sometimes those patients begin to show some better signs of life. That is not a function of the OPO. That is a function of the attending physicians and hospitals. And we saw in Secretary Kennedy's own action and publication that rural and small hospitals are where this is most likely to happen.
Right.
That is not an OPO function. That's the kind of facts we need out there to restore trust in the U.S.
Jennifer Milton, Chief Administrator for University Health Transplant Institute, and also Joe Nisbral, Texas Organ Sharing Alliance. Thank you so much. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.